Good morning. I'm Christina Lopez-Guttardi, Assistant Chair for the Forum Program, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Miller Center and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which produces the Virginia Festival of the Book. This event is both a book festival event as well as a Miller Center forum. So I'd like to thank the many volunteers who plan festival events, and they've asked if you could please fill out one of the evaluation forms, which I believe you got on your seats before leaving today. You'll have the opportunity to ask questions and to buy copies of the books following the presentations. And for those of you who are new to the Miller Center, I'd like to especially welcome you. And if you have any questions about Miller Center programs or would like to take a look around, we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Our next forum will take place on Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. We'll be hosting Philip Bobbitt, one of the nation's leading constitutional theorists at Columbia University Law School. He'll be discussing Terror and Consent, the Wars for the 21st Century. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our program today is America in Transition, Between War and War. Our panel includes Mark Silverstone, an associate professor with the Presidential Recordings Program here at the Miller Center. Mark joined the Miller Center in 2000 after receiving a master's degree in international affairs from Columbia University and his PhD in U.S. foreign relations from Ohio University. He is the author of the recently published book, Constructing the Monolith, the United States, Great Britain, and International Communism, 1945 to 1950. At the Miller Center, Mark's work focuses on the recordings of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, with a special emphasis on their foreign policy, particularly involving Vietnam. And we welcome back James Goldgeier to the Miller Center, who is a professor of political science and international affairs at the George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has authored co-authored three books on foreign policy, including the one that he'll be presenting today, America Between the Wars. His articles have appeared in a variety of publications, including Foreign Policy Magazine, The Washington Post, The Financial Times, and The Weekly Standard. He's held fellowships at Stanford University, the Brookings Institution, the Library of Congress, and the Woodrow Wilson Center. And he's also served at the State Department and on the National Security Staff. Please join me in welcoming Mark and Jim.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you, Christina. And thank you, the Miller Center. And thank you, Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. It's a pleasure to be here. And happy spring, everyone. It's a nice weekend coming up. I started constructing the monolith years ago as part of a graduate school project that I was working on with friends. We had actually founded a little business venture called the Time Streams Group. And we were interested in creating historical simulations. And we had put together one, a prototype on the dropping of the bomb. And we were searching around for others. And we were interested in the early Cold War and in the formation of a Cold War consciousness. And so we thought, wouldn't it be a great idea to try to recreate the process by which Americans, at least, came to understand the Soviet Union as a monolithic threat? So building the monolith was our model, and I became extremely interested in that, so much so that I turned it into my dissertation, which was titled All Roads Lead to Moscow. And along the way, it then became Constructing the Monolith. And as I delved into this more deeply, it became a curious issue for me as well, because given the nature of international communism, in the interwar years, and even during wartime, there was a host of fissures in the movement, between parties, between national parties, with Stalin proclaiming many roads to communism that various parties could follow. There were divisions between, certainly in the United States, between Browderites and Shachtmanites and Lovestoneites. And then you have, I suppose, the ultimate image of a movement that was rife with fissures being that of Leon Trotsky with a hole in his head. Clearly, things were not all well in the communist camp. So why is it that Americans came to see communism as this unified, well-oiled global conspiracy? And to what extent were Americans uniquely beholden to that idea? So I began to ask those questions and then try to answer them. And I thought to really do it justice, I needed to go back further because the events of the early Cold War were couched in a broader historical context. And so I explored what I call in the book an Anglo-American historical consciousness that goes back beyond the founding of the United States, back to the time when people had first conceived of America as really a new world, and looked at the dynamics of Whiggism, this notion that history moves in a direction, onward and upward, an upward spiral of progress, with Britain and then America being the outposts of this new world, bringing light to the darkened areas of the globe. And I took that idea of Whiggism, of republicanism in American history, and cast that as my backdrop against which the events of the early Cold War years were interpreted. They created kind of a narrative framework for understanding what was happening in Eastern Europe as well as in Asia. There were medium-term dynamics I thought that were important as well. I looked at the impact of the idea of totalitarianism during the interwar years. It first became important to Americans and Britons in the late 1920s and then in the 1930s as well. What is this new dynamic that is helping to push along mass societies? How is society to be organized in the modern era? What are the dangers in that type of organization? And how did the British as well as the Americans understand that? And why were these two images of totalitarian forces, communism and Nazism, seen to be parts of a single whole? There came to be in the late 1930s an image of red fascism, as people referred to it, a melding of the two ideas that seemed to be particularly explosive. And so these were kind of the medium-term dynamics, the understanding of ideology and its work that helped to, again, inform the events of the era. And then finally, I looked at those events themselves, the very short-term dynamics of the early Cold War, of the wartime years, and then early Cold War years. Everything from the way that Stalin had halted the Red Army at the Vistula River in Warsaw in 1944, on up to try to explain why Americans and Britons saw malevolence in Soviet actions. I continued through the book. I kind of broke it into a couple different sections, really pre-1948 and post-1948. The first half was on the emergence of ideology itself as an important construct for Americans and Britons in trying to understand what that enigma of Soviet communism was all about. People had no idea, and they were grasping at straws to try to figure out what did it mean that Stalin delivered this election speech in February of 1946, in which he's no longer talking about allied unity and the big three, and is now talking about the inevitable conflict between communism and capitalism. Why is he changing his tune? What is this all about? That approach informs that first half of the book, and it ends really in 1948, at which point we have really the signal development in this understanding of a communist monolith, that being the expulsion of Tito's Yugoslavia from the Cominform. The Cominform had been an organization created in 1948, kind of a modern-day version in some respects of the Comintern itself. The Comintern being the international organization that had been created in 1919, and then which Stalin had disbanded in 1943, kind of as a sop to Western sensibilities. We are fighting this war together, and Stalin was giving the Allied, the Western Allied powers, the British and the Americans, a sense that he could be trusted, that he was a friend, that perhaps they could even work together more closely in the post-war era. So the Cominform's expulsion of Tito seemed to be an indication to Americans and to Britons that what was once regarded as a monolith no longer was, that there was a chink in the Soviet armor. And I continue to try to explain how British and American policymakers, as well as British and American publics, understood that development. On the one hand, it looked quite obvious that the Soviet Union and international communism would never be the same. If there once was such a thing as a monolith, well, there no longer is. And so what you began to see in both official as well as kind of mass circulation periodicals is this notion of a monolith almost with parentheses wrapped around the word, as though to suggest that it was something that was now obsolete. As we move through 1948, however, and as there are various developments that take place, it seems as though Stalin and international communism really was a monolithic movement. As there are purges throughout Eastern Europe, as the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia is actually voting together on a conference that dealt with the Danube waterway, the fact that Stalin that Tito was not lashing out at this point at Stalin so dramatically suggested that perhaps this was a family fight and they might fall back in together. And so whereas the parentheses were once put around that word or term, the monolith, it began to fall away. And international communism once again came to look like that international conspiratorial movement. There were members of the State Department hierarchy, as well as people in the press, who consistently derided that notion, however, and tried to get the message out. It's dangerous for us to talk about an international communist monolith. It serves Stalin's purposes. Every single time we talk about the coordination between communist parties and suggest that there really is this iron discipline that the communists exhibit, we're casting to the other side potential, if not friends, then to some degree allies in this emerging Cold War struggle. And so there is a belief, particularly among folks in the policy planning staff in the State Department, that America's rhetorical policy was entirely wrong-headed, and there were efforts to try to recalibrate the message. But they really fell on deaf ears, because as the American political season heated up in late 1948, as the Chinese communists became ever more effective in their fight against the Chinese nationalists, as Mao decided to lean toward one side in the international struggle in June 1948, then we have the founding of the People's Republic in the fall of 1949. Any opportunity really to talk about international communism in more subtle and sophisticated terms ended. It fell away. And by the time that China had entered the Korean War late in 1950, which is where I end the book, it's really accepted entirely, certainly by the American public and largely by the British public as well, that international communism really was a monolithic movement. I tried to demonstrate in various spots where officials held this open, where they suggested, no, let's not be too hasty. There really is a likelihood that Mao and Stalin will fall out in the future. It's going to be very difficult for the Soviets to push the Chinese around. Mao has many of the same attributes as Tito did. He came to power of his own accord. Certainly there's no Red Army, major Red Army role in helping him establish the PRC. So there was a possibility that what had happened in Yugoslavia could be replicated in China as well. But as developments took place throughout 1950, the early part of 1950 and then into the end, it became clear, as it was perceived, that Mao and the PRC really were the handmaidens of Soviet policy in East Asia. I conclude by saying that given all of these events and the backdrop against which they unfolded, interpreting international communism as a monolithic movement was a rational response to events of the day. It wasn't necessarily an accurate response to the events of the day. And I go to some pains to explain where there were fissures between communist parties and communist states. But given the emphasis that the communists themselves had placed upon displaying their image, highlighting the notion that international communism was a monolithic movement, it made good sense to those living at the time to see the movement as a single coordinated whole.
Thank you, Jim. Great, thank you. And thanks for the invitation to be here. And so I'd ask you now to fast forward 40 years. 1989, the collapse of communism in Central and Eastern Europe, and the end of the Cold War. And as Mark has set this up nicely, you know, we have a situation after, for the four decades after his study, a country that was geared toward containing the Soviet Union and containing communism. And then in 1989, that's no longer relevant. So now what? What should be the purpose of American foreign policy in the aftermath of the collapse of communism? Not obvious then, not obvious now. And the reason that my co-author and I wrote this book was we had several reasons, but largely to help us understand how we got where we are today and understand this very important period between the fall of the Berlin Wall, such a hopeful moment, the emergence of the United States as the lone superpower, the ensuing collapse of the Soviet Union, and the years then leading up toward obviously a very different day, 9/11, the attacks on the United States from Al-Qaeda. And an effort to try to understand how the issues that we are dealing with, whether you're talking about countries such as Iran, Iraq, North Korea, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, terrorism itself, globalization, all these issues did not arise, as many people in this country seem to believe, with 9/11. They were all already there before. And in fact, if you just think about this, the current financial crisis, we have big sections in the book on the Mexican peso crisis of the mid-1990s and the Asian financial crisis of 1997, 1998, which had people been paying attention in recent years, would have understood from those crises the level of interconnectedness among with the United States and other countries in the world. Just say a few things about sort of some a couple big themes of the book. One, we try not just to talk about the foreign policy issues that the United States has been dealing with since 1989, but also about the politics of foreign policy. A lot of books about foreign policy neglect the politics. A lot of books on politics talk about one side or the other. We look at both the Democratic and Republican parties and how they evolved in the aftermath of the Cold War, because the Cold War had a huge impact on both political parties. For the Republicans, anti-communism had been the glue that held the party together. And once communism goes, so does anti-communism. And you see a big division within the Republican Party emerge in 1989, lasting up until today. So for those people looking at the party today thinking, gee, the divisions are the result of a bad campaign by John McCain last year, or things that are going on now, these are things that have been going on for 20 years within the Republican Party. And understanding the splits, especially between the realists and the neoconservatives since 1989, extremely important for understanding the state of the Republican Party today. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, the end of the Cold War was a huge opportunity because the Democrats had been beaten up in the second half of the Cold War for being too soft on communism, not robust enough on national security. And with the end of the Cold War, just as anti-communism was irrelevant with the end of the Cold War, so was being soft on communism. And it was a huge opportunity for the Democrats to reshape themselves, as Bill Clinton tried to do in the 1990s, with great relevance for thinking about where the party is today under Barack Obama. But I want, in the few minutes that I have for this formal remarks, to talk about a different theme of the book, which is this: the effort in the aftermath of the Cold War to come up with a replacement for the containment doctrine that had driven American foreign policy for 40 years. You know, in the period that Mark is writing about in his book, you have George Kennan articulating this notion that the United States, the purpose of the United States, is to contain Soviet Union, contain Soviet communism. And with 1989, you have the end of the need for containment and the search for something new. And what was fascinating for me as we did the research for the book, we knew, for example, that certainly for the foreign policy elite in Washington, there was this huge scramble after 1989 to try to come up with the new doctrine, because people figured that, you know, they could be famous just like George Kennan if they could come up with the successor to containment. And you had all sorts of people offering their thoughts on what things should be. You had a lot of thoughts that were analytical more than they were prescriptive, the end of history argument of Frank Fukuyama or the clash of civilizations argument of Sam Huntington. You also had a wave of attempts within the government George H.W. Bush's New World Order, Anthony Lake, Bill Clinton's first national security advisor, his notion of democratic engagement and enlargement, Clinton himself, the Third Way, which was largely domestic but also had an international component. What was interesting to me in the research was just how obsessed Bill Clinton was during his presidency, how frustrated he was with his team for their inability to come up with a successor to containment, constantly saying to them, how come we haven't come up with the new bumper sticker that could easily explain American foreign policy to the public? I think it's important to understand that there is this belief that for the public to understand what America is doing, it's important to have this single, simple phrase. And the argument in the book is that that is illusory in the world in which we live today. We don't live in a world with one big enemy like the Soviet Union. We don't live in a world with the monolith. And of course, as Mark has explained and others in this room in their own writings, there was a myth that there was a monolith anyway. But doubly hard, if not more than doubly hard, in the aftermath of the Cold War, because think about the full range of issues, from states like Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, to weapons of mass destruction, to terrorism, to globalization, to climate change, the rise of China and India, dealing with the reassertive Russia. All these issues, you can't put them all in one single simple phrase. But if you look at the history of the last 20 years, you look at the frustration, the effort of the Clinton administration to do this, the criticism in 2000 by the Bush team, the Bush campaign team, that the Clinton team was too ad hoc. They didn't have that bumper sticker, so that meant they didn't know what they were doing in terms of a strategy for global affairs. The Bush team came in 2001. They didn't really have a phrase either. But they had one after September 11th, the war on terror. And if you look at the way that they articulate the war on terror, the way they use the war on terror as a frame, it's an effort to say, this is our purpose in the world. And of course, as we know, the war on terror has at least two problems with it. One, in terms of dealing with that specific threat, terrorism, it doesn't really encompass the range of tools necessary to deal with Islamic extremism, a war on terror. And in fact, it's interesting, both if you look at what's been said by many of the people who were involved in the articulation originally, as well as those who spoke to us for our book, and we tried to talk with everybody from left to right on the political spectrum for this book. For example, Colin Powell, who we spoke with, said to us flat out, the war on terror is a terrible phrase. He said, this is not the Soviets coming back. And a desire to have a different way of looking at the problem. And we've seen an administration coming in that doesn't want to talk about it as a war on terror, wants to talk about it very differently. But even if that had been the right phrase, the right way to look at terrorism, think about all the other foreign policy problems that it leaves out, right? Maybe it's the right way to deal with that specific one, but it doesn't help you in thinking about all the other problems that the United States faces. And there's a moment in 1994, I mentioned that the Clinton team was very eager to try to figure out, how do we come up with the new bumper sticker? How do we come up with the new doctrine of containment? And in 1994, George Kennan was 90 years old in Princeton, New Jersey, and the State Department team invited him for dinner to ask his advice. They said, you're the guy that came up with the guiding phrase for the Cold War. How do we do this now in 1994? How do we come up with the new bumper sticker to guide American foreign policy? And Kennan said to them, you don't live in that kind of world. You're not going to be able to come up with a bumper sticker. And if you want my advice to you is, try to come up with a thoughtful paragraph or two. And it was good advice then, and it's good advice now. And I think one of the important features of this new administration, we saw a little bit during the campaign last year, what's going to be the Obama doctrine, what would be the McCain doctrine. And I think one of the things that I think is refreshing about this new team coming in is that, at least so far, we'll see how things go and the demands from the public, they don't seem obsessed with trying to find a single simple phrase. They seem to be focused on the fact that there are major problems out there to be solved. Certainly, the United States needs to have priorities and principles to guide it as it thinks about how to solve the myriad problems that we face. And there's no question for the president, and I hope we can have some discussion about it, the number one problem is certainly the financial crisis. If we don't get our economic house in order, we're not going to have a very effective foreign policy. But it certainly also the administration comes in with this at this unprecedented time of not only a financial crisis, but also facing these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the drawdown in Iraq and the beefing up of the American presence in Afghanistan and how to deal with those issues. So we'll see whether or not they can come up with the thoughtful paragraph or two that Kennan suggested 15 years ago. But I think that it is important that we not fall into this trap. And it was certainly a trap that was very easy for people to fall into at the end of the Cold War. This notion that there's got to be some simple bumper sticker that would define American foreign policy, because that's what we had been used to for 40 years. We had been used to the notion that we had this doctrine of containment. Now, of course, people forget, and there's a lot of nostalgia for this notion that it was so easy then. People forget about the threat of nuclear Holocaust. People think, oh, it was, there was general agreement, bipartisan agreement. People forget about how partisan the period was, whether we're talking about the Vietnam War, the attacks on the Reagan policy on Central America in the 1980s. There was plenty of partisanship during the Cold War. It may have been exacerbated by certain things that occurred after the Cold War. But people got used to the notion that you would have this guiding phrase. As I said, the Bush administration sought it in 2001, found it with the war on terror. But again, we should have learned. It's not the world we live in. And we need to have a much more sophisticated way of thinking about American foreign policy, what our priorities and principles are, how to deal with the range of problems that we face. Hopefully this book, by looking at how we tried to deal with these issues in this period between the fall of the wall and the attacks of September 11th, helped to give some background into how to think about these problems. So with that, thank you, and look forward to your questions.
Thank you both. In a few moments, I'll head to the back of the room to begin taking questions from the audience, so I invite you all to queue up in the back with me. But let me begin the conversation by asking, both books essentially deal with how we look at American history, the different historical roots of different eras, how paradigms, worldviews, and eventually foreign policy is formed. Jim, in your book, yours is based largely on the role of specific political, high-level political actors, political debates both between and within parties. And Mark's analysis seems to look at some of these discussions, but also looks at the role of the media, popular periodicals, and some public events that were sort of seen as where national dialogue was at the time. Can you each comment on your sources of research and on your methods of analysis as ultimately being a view towards the foreign policy formation?
Sure. Yes, I'd be happy to. I thought it was important to try to get a broader sense of how the country as a whole, oftentimes when we're dissecting American foreign policy, particularly in the early Cold War, we're looking at what high-level policymakers had to say to one another, the pronouncements that they made, the documents that they wrote, the exchange of memos from one station to another, or we may look at what's happening on the ground. We may look at the emergence of a broader Cold War culture. And quite frequently, when we do look at Cold War culture, we're looking really at the 1950s. We're not looking too much at the late 1940s, at least historians haven't. I wanted to get a sense of what America might have looked like at this time if you bring those two together. If you look at what at how people are thinking in the State Department, to an extent in the War Department and then Defense Department, and certainly in the White House, but then if you look at what is actually happening on the ground, the events and spectacles, as Christina alludes to, there are tons of pageants and spectacles that Americans engage in everyday life, which in many ways kind of give you a clue to how they felt about communism, whether it's an I Am an American Day parade down Fifth Avenue or a Loyalty Day parade, or whether it's the staging of a mock communist coup in the city of Mosinee, Wisconsin, in which the theaters are taken over by the KGB and all of the elements of a Soviet society is played out there. These matter in shaping a public consciousness, and in many respects, they are developments that take place not because it's government officials who are telling those on the ground, you know what, we really want you to portray communism in this way because it's going to serve our broader interests, our policy interests. These are grassroots initiatives. Yes, there are some ties between some of the folks who organize them and the government, but in many ways, they are grassroots initiatives, things that people come to on their own because of sincerely held fears about what communism means for the world at large and what it might do if it somehow magically takes root in American soil. I do some of that with the British scene as well, but it was much harder for this type of grassroots anti-communism to take root in British soil for a variety of dynamics. But in general, it was striking how much British and American publics saw communism itself as a monolithic movement. The nature, the tenor, the volume of the anti-communism was different in the two societies, but their conclusions were remarkably similar. So I was trying to look at this from a top-down and as well as a bottom-up perspective.
And ours is different. It's both an intellectual history and a political history. It's a more recent period, so harder in terms of the elite level to get the kind of documents that you would normally want to have to really understand the debates that were taking place. But we were really looking at the elite level, not just inside government, but outside government. How were people thinking about America's role in the world after the end of the Cold War? While we were able, of course, to go through whatever had been written in secondary sources and what the people themselves had been writing, and we got a few documents through the Freedom of Information Act, not as many as we would have hoped for. But the book is largely based on interviews, and so it was fun to do. And we were able to speak with quite a number of people, as I mentioned in my remarks, across the political spectrum, from Ralph Nader on the left to Pat Buchanan on the right, and lots of folks in between on the Democratic side, people like Madeleine Albright and Robert Rubin, and people on the Republican side like Newt Gingrich and Colin Powell, really wanted to try to tell this story of how they viewed what America should be doing in the world after the end of the Cold War. I would say that to the extent that there's anything sort of on the public views, we certainly went through public opinion polls and tried to understand the way in which public views may have interacted with the way that the elites were articulating their own positions. I would say the one thing that's most missing, because it just wasn't in the framework that we were using to write this book, and I hope that someone will someday do this, which is to look at what the rest of the world was thinking about American foreign policy during this period and how they were reacting to this unipolar moment, this lone superpower, and the kinds of ways that America saw itself as it emerged after the end of the Cold War.
Hi, Jeff LeGros, Department of Politics in the Miller Center. These sound like two really fascinating books, but of course they're very different. I have a question that maybe crosses the two books, and that is how you assess the cost and benefits of having a doctrine or not having a doctrine. So for Mark, the question is, yes, there was this monolithic image, and that monolithic image we found may have had some costs later on during the Cold War in terms of seeing a monolithic threat where it wasn't, and therefore reacting wrongly to that. But even given that, were the benefits of having a clear doctrine and responding to it as a monolith worth it because of the coordination and unified effort that came out of it? Okay, so it's the reverse question for Jim, right? So during the post-Cold War period, did it damage U.S. foreign policy not to have a bumper sticker? That is, a bumper sticker necessarily excludes some things, but it also unifies and directs the government towards particular ends. And one of the critiques of the Clinton administration is they were just putting out fires. There was no direction. So were the costs and benefits of not having a doctrine justified in that period? So we could say, yes, there were costs to not having a doctrine, but the benefits of not having one exceeded the cost still. Clinton did the right thing. So.
Thanks, Jeff. Great question. First, on the benefits, and there were some in seeing communism as a monolithic movement, particularly when you look at the period after 1948 and after the Tito split, but beyond that, really, after the fall of China. What now? How do American policymakers respond to this event? There were two schools of thought about how to drive a wedge between the Soviet Union and this newly founded People's Republic, and between Stalin and Mao. One school of thought was that you dangle the economic carrot in front of Mao, suggest that there might be still some ways that we can do business together, and try to wean the PRC away from the Soviet grip. Certainly it wasn't in it entirely at that point, although people feared that it might be. That was one way of looking at it, what people referred to as kind of a soft wedge policy. There was another way of looking at how one might drive a wedge, and that took its cue from what happened to Tito in Yugoslavia. The analysis was that the reason that Tito rebelled, and that was a faulty assumption, it's a faulty assumption in many ways, that Tito was essentially kicked out of the communist orbit rather than him deciding to leave it on his own. The assumption was that the reason that there were problems there was because, in many ways, he had gotten too close to Stalin, and that finally he had seen what a lousy ally he was. So the alternative, how does one deal with China now? Let's force the two of them together. Let's talk about communism as a monolithic movement. Let's suggest that this really is the way it works. And the more that we shove Mao closer to Stalin, the better Mao has a chance to see what Stalin is really like as an ally, and then he will recoil. And there will be our opportunity to capitalize upon that. Now, would this happen in the near future? Probably not. It was going to happen years down the road. So it was a policy that was very difficult to sustain because you had to have the domestic political constituency to mouth these kinds of things. And it was very hard to talk about the possibilities of maybe some kind of nationalist, communist alternative. How can you be supportive of one type of communism when you're denigrating all others? And in a political environment that's dominated by McCarthyism, that was really tough. So while it was an aspiration, it was never a great likelihood that they were going to succeed rhetorically there. Just on the flip side of that, the liabilities, there were many. I'm not sure that there were many in the near term in terms of foreign policy. I'm not so sure how different American foreign policy would have been in the late 1940s or early 1950s, or more specifically, again, before Stalin died, if Americans had been able to act upon the belief, more accurate belief, that there were significant tensions within the fold. Sometimes those tensions were believed to be more dramatic than they really were, but I think that the way America might have benefited from a more frank discussion about what the communist world really looked like is in our domestic politics. It would have been easier to talk about trying to support one communist entity as opposed to another. Certainly they were doing that by the late 1940s with Tito, but State Department staffers recognized all kinds of problems with doing that. It would have been a whole lot better, however, if they were able to act upon those assumptions and try to draw either the Chinese away from the Soviets or Soviets away from the Chinese, as they did in the early 1970s, it'd be really nice if they were able to do that in the early 1960s. My sense is that what had happened in Southeast Asia would have been very different if that was the case. So, great question.
Yeah, thanks, and of course gives me an opportunity to plug the LeGros-Leffler book on grand strategy, which is important for anyone who wants to think about this issue. I have to say, both the research for the book and the recent events in this country have made me very humble, just in terms of my own thinking about how we should do this, and I think we should approach these issues with a great amount of humility. First of all, let's just remember with containment and George Kennan, he grew very unhappy, and you know, Mel's written about this, about how this was implemented. I do think also, in fairness, the story that we tell of the Clinton administration is a team that came in 1993-94, a president who came in thinking he wasn't going to be dealing with foreign policy. He thought he was elected on, it's the economy, stupid, the Cold War was over, he wasn't going to deal with foreign policy, and a real mishandling of events in 1993-94. You read that section of the book, it's a very ugly story. But he actually became much more comfortable as a foreign policy president over time, and we arguably became pretty good at it. But I do come back again to his own frustration, and I think it is very important that he was frustrated with what he felt was his inability to explain what he was doing to the American public. The issue he cared most about was globalization and the American response to globalization. His view was that this was a fact of life, and you couldn't wall yourself off from the rest of the world. You had to integrate with the rest of the world. The jobs that America was losing weren't coming back, so Clinton's view was you had to create new ways of creating new jobs in the information technology world. And we spoke with Robert Rubin, for example, about these issues, and he said that his biggest regret was that in 1994 that they didn't lay out a multi-year strategy of what it was they were trying to do that would have enabled them to explain better to the American people. Clinton, in 2000, his last foreign policy speech, he went to the one state he hadn't been to yet, Nebraska, and in December of 2000 gave a foreign policy address, and he goes off on a tangent in which he talks about how frustrated he was, that he felt like he never explained to the American people exactly what he understood globalization to be and how we would need to respond to it. So I think in that sense, that the cost of not having an overarching frame, even if people understood what it was they were doing, was that you do have to explain to the American people what it is that you are trying to accomplish. You mentioned the whole critique that they were putting out fires. You know, in the economic realm, the first Treasury Secretary for the Bush team, Paul O'Neill, this was his big criticism of the Clinton team. Well, they were like firemen, just going around putting out fires. You know, we need a framework so we don't have these kind of economic crises again. Think about the fires we were trying to put out in the last year of the Bush administration going into this year, right? It's a lot harder to do in practice. And again, very humbling, I would hope, to those people who were very critical of the team in the 1990s for putting out the fires in Mexico or the Asian financial crisis. And in fact, the thing that I think is most unfortunate is people didn't look more closely at what we were doing in that period to draw more lessons to today. In fact, what stunned me in my previous book was on U.S.-Russia policy toward this period, so I'd interviewed a lot of these folks at Treasury on the Asian financial crisis because it ends up affecting Russia in August of 1998. And what was fascinating then was how the Treasury team in 97-98 said that they were blindsided by how interconnected the world had become, that this crisis that begins in Thailand could then spread to Korea and then Brazil and then to Russia. So you would have thought we would have learned. And look where we were last summer with people around the world saying, well, the United States is having a subprime crisis. But, you know, we're not, you know, other Russia is saying we're not going to be affected by that. Gordon Brown, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer during 1997-98, wrote a piece in the Washington Post late in 2008 saying, we are now in the first crisis of our globalized world. So even he didn't remember 1997-98. It's unbelievable, the short memories that we have. But I just all as a way of saying that, I mean, these problems are so complicated, it's hard. But presidents need a way of explaining what they're doing. And I think in this case, I'll just end with this one. We know, for example, that Barack Obama is oriented toward trying to engage the rest of the world as a way of promoting a stronger foreign policy. Right? We're going to try engagement with Iran. We're going to try engagement with Russia, push the reset button. Well, what happens if the engagement doesn't work? What happens if Iran goes ahead and develops nuclear weapons? We may, in fact, be in a stronger position vis-a-vis the international community because we did try engagement. But we're still going to have a huge crisis on our hands. And similarly with Russia, we may be able to accomplish certain things that we weren't able to before. But there are huge differences of interests and worldviews between the United States and Russia that aren't going to be solved by engagement alone. So I just urge some humility and some caution in thinking about these questions.
How about a post-war bumper sticker that reads, "Go for full spectrum dominance"?
Can you elaborate on what you would mean by that?
This is something that the Pentagon is using, a term that the Pentagon is using. And it seems to me there's a difference between often what is really going on in terms of foreign policy and what a leader wants the American public to know about what is going on with regard to foreign policy. And certainly if you look at what's happened since the end of World War II, full spectrum dominance is not a bad term. I mean, we have military presence in, 191 countries now. We have, I think, a presence, military presence in 125 or 130, and our CIA around the world has toppled democratically elected leaders and supported extreme right-wing dictators. I mean, how much does a leader want the American public to know about this? What's really going on?
Well, my response to that would just be that, I mean, obviously the United States is engaged throughout the world in a variety of ways. And again, one of the things I think that we do in the book is to try to show the debates about this. If you look back, for example, in 1992, there was a leak of the Pentagon's defense planning guidance under the direction of then Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and his Undersecretary Paul Wolfowitz and others who were working on that, like Zal Khalilzad and Scooter Libby, who people came to know much better later on. And this was an argument for, as America coming out of the Cold War, to basically preserve American hegemony for as far as the eye could see and to prevent the emergence of any regional rivals. And it was very controversial because it wasn't just about preventing the emergence of countries like Iraq as a regional rival, but also countries like Japan and Germany in the aftermath of the Cold War. But as we show in the book, while this was one argument that was being put forward at the time, there was another that was never leaked. In fact, our discussion of the document is the first discussion out there. This was a document that was being put forward by the State Department that recognized a very different world in which there were limits to American resources. There were new transnational threats. There were need to work multilaterally with allies, need to work through the United Nations. And that's one of the things that we try to do in the book, is to show that there are these debates going on all the time about what the United States should be doing. And your comment about sort of, you know, full spectrum dominance, we live in a world now in which America, we understand that our resources are not infinite. And we need to think about the ways of matching our foreign policy goals with a world in which we understand that we cannot do everything, or we will spend ourselves into the ground.
Bob Saylor from the law school. You preempted me a little bit when I listened, Professor, to your opening statement about the absence of a bumper sticker to define our foreign policy. I was saying to myself, I think if you gave me a final exam, I might not get an F. If I said it's not quite a bumper sticker, but I do believe, and invite your comments on it, that the new administration has been pretty effective in establishing that American foreign policy's essence now Its theme is engagement and openness. In contrast to containment, that's a pretty global shift from containment to engagement. And it seems to me that's a fair description of where we are in our foreign policy. It may not work everywhere, but they've been pretty darned effective in articulating that that's America's foreign policy right now. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I just would say that if you look back at 1993, the Clinton team came in and said, we're going to engage, and we're going to emphasize multilateralism, and we're going to work through the United Nations. And they grew frustrated. And there were crises that emerged that they had to deal with. And there were allies that were recalcitrant. And there was a UN that was difficult to work through. And in fact, you end up with the phrase during the Clinton years, multilateral if we can, unilateral if we must. You know, we went to war over Kosovo without UN Security Council authorization. That was a war run through through NATO, but the United States knew that it would never get UN Security Council authorization because the Russians and Chinese would veto. So I'm all for engagement. I think the new administration, you know, needs to develop a new approach, and certainly you know, the rest of the world is welcoming the notion that the administration is in listening mode, and when it talks about consultation, for example, with allies, it doesn't mean by consultation that it's going to them and saying, here's what we're doing, we just wanted to let you know, that it's actually going and asking them what their ideas are. But I would again give a word of caution. And it's interesting to think about how things have changed both for us and the rest of the world. In 1993, Bosnia was a huge problem that needed to be solved. You had this war going on. What was the West going to do? And Warren Christopher, in May of 1993, went to Europe, and he went, as he said, in listening mode. And the Europeans were aghast. What's the U.S. plan? They wanted to know. But we don't have a plan. We wanted to consult with you. Well, they didn't have an idea either. They wanted the United States to tell them what the plan was. Now, I think after the 8 years of the Bush administration, people are welcoming listening mode. They also recognize the United States is not while the United States is still the leading power, it's not as dominant as it was in the 1990s and does need to work with others. But again, a word of caution, listening is good, but it's also helpful if others have some ideas to share about how to solve problems. And we're only a couple months into the new administration. And as time goes on, they will inevitably become frustrated. They're already frustrated with the Europeans that the Europeans aren't doing more to offer a bigger stimulus package to help with getting out of the current financial crisis. They're going to become frustrated as the United States does more in Afghanistan that the Europeans aren't doing so. I think that that's one of the reasons why it's important to go back and look at this period. Look at how the Clinton administration came in with a lot of the same themes, and of course a lot of the same people are in the Obama administration, and they grew pretty frustrated pretty quickly.
Hi, it's Mel Leffler. I really have enjoyed both your books and have learned a lot from them. I have a question for both of you that links it together. I wonder if there really ever was, Jim, a bumper sticker that was called containment, or whether we've constructed that in our own minds. Because really, when you think about the whole long trajectory of the Cold War, how many presidents really talked about American foreign policy in terms of containment? Did Eisenhower use the word containment a lot? Did Kennedy use it in his most famous speech at American University that sort of tried to outline a new foreign policy? He didn't talk about containment. Johnson, yes, but Nixon, no. Carter, no. Reagan, no. He wouldn't have used the word containment. In fact, I think a lot of scholars have conjured up that notion in part to simplify what you're saying, is that making foreign policy always was complex. It is complex now. What really distinguished it was not that there was a bumper sticker that defined a strategy, but it was easy like Mark is saying, to talk about an enemy. I mean, during the Cold War, it wasn't that we had one simple bumper sticker strategy. We had a bumper sticker enemy, communism. And that's what the Bush two people sort of constructed after 9/11. There was some sort of enemy, terrorism. But that didn't constitute a strategy either. So it's much easier to construct an enemy because you have a sense of fear than it is to ever to have created a bumper sticker in terms of a strategy. I just like to have your comments on that.
I would completely agree with that. I think there's a general, if not one would articulate, you know, if they wouldn't articulate the doctrine of containment straight throughout these presidencies, there was at least a posture of holding the line, of not letting any free areas go red, and if possible, maybe trying to turn those areas that were red back to some other color that was more preferable to the Western side. So yes, containment wasn't articulated in the speeches, but I think that there is a general stance, posture that these presidents assumed without using the word. Likewise, there is a general recognition, understanding, at least up through the Nixon period, that communism worked in this certain way without continuing to use the word the monolith. I mean, there's a sense that this is how communist powers work together. And because they ascribe to this single dogma, they are, of course, going to be beholden to that dogma, and they're going to act accordingly. There must be a center of the communist faith somewhere. It must be the Kremlin. And so people use this kind of religious imagery in many ways to try to understand what this new creed was all about. So again, without using the word the monolith, and I think in some ways the monolith dies out as a term that you hear in public throughout the latter part of the 1950s and into the 1960s. But in understanding of its processes, that is still fairly ingrained in the psyche of policymakers and Americans until you have Nixon quite explicitly operating on the assumption that there is multipolarity in the communist world and that we need to take advantage of it.
Well, thanks for the question. And one of the things that we try to do in the book is talk about a little bit about the misplaced nostalgia for the Cold War, this notion that things were easier then, that everyone agreed then, that there was bipartisanship then. We note the comment that Bill Clinton made to National Security Advisor Lake in the fall of 1993 about, you know, we had crises in Haiti, Somalia, and Bosnia, and telling Lake, gee, you know, I really miss the Cold War. This was insane. First of all, he never could have been elected president had the Cold War been going on, because his experiences wouldn't have allowed that to happen. He was only able to be president because the Cold War was over. I think the more important thing is that, especially for our story, is that you had a government that was completely geared toward the Soviet threat. And everyone who worked in the State Department, for example, in one way or another, worked on U.S.-Soviet relations. Whether they worked directly on the U.S.-Soviet relationship, or whether they worked on Africa policy, or Latin America policy, or the law of the sea, whatever they worked on, it was seen through the prism of the U.S.-Soviet rivalry. And the problem when the Cold War ends and the Soviet Union collapses is you have a government that's not geared and people who aren't trained to deal with this new world, whether we're talking about the folks from AID, Agency for International Development, who take years to sort of get the training they need to work through the kind of new challenges that they face, or people working on particular regions. The way that the State Department is organized, you can argue it's still the way the State Department is organized, is not geared effectively toward the world in which we live. Our organizations like NATO, which have had a huge difficulty adapting still, 20 years later, to the end of the Cold War, and the way that SHAPE, the NATO military arm, is organized to deal with the new threats that we faced. It's not very well organized to deal with it. So I think that, bigger than just the question, which I think is important, of whether or not we even agreed during the Cold War of what it was we were doing, we had a government that was structured toward that enemy. And everyone working in the government was working in the context of that relationship with that enemy. And we've needed something very different over the last 20 years, and we're still struggling with that adaptation.
We'll have to end with that question, but we thank you both for sharing your work with us. Thank you very much.